of tear gas canisters. The Maribor uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system which sends speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media embedded behind police lines portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are two different versions of this film, and I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking? And
yeah,
that it was done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly, and you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get that. What it has, and what really is its strength, is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something. And in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine. But they're all big, epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, it was very bitty, but that was its nature, and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but I that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd be a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I thought there could have been a little bit more to show how they were to how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of the Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but when as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of, you were right, you plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay, you know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That was intentional.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learn that they've just been named European City of Culture. Mm-hmm. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said? And do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying, in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. Let's get our own messages across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that mm-hmm. certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris, and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. Mm-hmm. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming mm-hmm. over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protesters and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected mm-hmm. to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, I don't think it needed to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing. And that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way authorities deal with what could be, you know, a perfectly reasonable protest ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, in the interactive part, this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, was trying to converse with a police officer, he says, "Take your helmet off, come and talk to us."
Yeah,
and I'd like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that one of their fellow citizens, and think, no, you're violent, and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest. And sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, actions and reactions, like we just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, violence, of course this should happen. It said, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kungler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan "Gotovi so," they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We're talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph. It is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they muddle through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, you know, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
Mm. And Maurice, what about, what do you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Maybe their goals were too short term, changing the mayor and removing the radar cameras.
Some of it seems a bit superficial, some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that they, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. Mm-hmm. There was someone talking about the social, the community type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? Something just in coming together is important.
It's about, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here. Yeah.
And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially at a time like now, this political climate, where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protest? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen in your... All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from, a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor and had no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, the anatomy of a protest, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, a dignified life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, I swear by God that I shall never join hands with them like those humbled, nor escape like the slaves. I consider death as nothing but prosperity, and life with the unjust as nothing but a source of blame and misfortune. Brothers and sisters, in order for us to be Muslims, in order for us to live an Islamic life, and if our lives have to be on the path of Islam, we have to look towards and turn towards Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam. In addition to Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has granted to us Ahlul Bayt. They're the biggest blessing. Their lives are a role model for us. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is not in agreement with living a life of disgust, of humiliation, of disrespect, of insult. And this is a lesson for us. We want to live a life that is respectable, that is dignified, that is reputable, that has a positive impact on our surroundings. We have to take the lesson from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The above two sentences that we recited from Imam Hussein alayhi salam from a speech of Imam are two clear signs of this reality. So, commit to yourself, you, your family, your friends, that you're going to live a dignified life, not a disgusting life. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about a dignified life and how to lead one. And for this, we turn to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who has provided us with instructions and guidelines and a living role model that we can follow. Now, humanity has been provided with many lessons to learn from the events that have happened in the history. Many of those events, they have been a divine enlightenment and a true road to salvation of mankind. When we look towards infallibles, their entire life, which spans over about 250 years, right? That becomes that guiding light for all of us to take principles out of and follow them if we are serious in living a dignified life, not just at an individual level, no, even at the governmental level, the social level, the country level, the region level, and at the level of the entire world, inshallah. A tradition reported by Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam reports that other than not accepting humiliation, Almighty Allah has given to believer a choice in all matters. See how important not accepting humiliation is. If you remember again, Imam Hussain alayhi salam said, "Hayhat min nazilla," that humiliation is far from us. So this is how a believer is supposed to be. If you want to live a dignified life, you have to stay away from humiliation, especially accepting humiliation. You don't have a choice there. It is a command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for a believer not to accept humiliation. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The limelight.
The abduction of indigenous children was a project meant to render their worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. This is perhaps why the Israeli regime military targets children. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Benny Bland Ryder. This article is published under the heading, From Boarding Schools to Child Detention, Lives of Children Matter. Stay tuned for the details. Yes, I am thinking of Palestinian children and undocumented children as well, mused Dean activist Melissa Tesso. They are literally being killed daily by these settler governments. As an essential part of her culture, running helps to process things. And so she did the 2.15 run in memory of 215 indigenous children who were found in a mass grave at Kamloops Residential School in Canada. On May 29, 2021, Al Jazeera reported that the remains of more than 200 indigenous children, some as young as 3, have been found at the site of a former residential school in Western Province of British Columbia. To our knowledge, these missing children are undocumented deaths. The Columbus Toskumpe First Nation Chief Rosanne Casimir explained, they are among the many victims of mental and sexual abuse, neglect, and other forms of violence over a period of 100 years during which church-supported boarding schools operated across Canada. By forcibly taking children from their families, the schools sought to break indigenous family and cultural ties in order to assimilate children into white Canadian society. According to Moskowitz Voices, co-founder of Bear Clan Patrol, Calgary, and chairman of MIM Social Justice Committee, approximately 6,000 native children died in residential schools from disease. Beatings, firing squads, malnutrition, and electrocution, among other forms of torture and neglect. The residential schools took the children from the land, Voices continues, adding, to disconnect people from their culture in order to take the land from children. Moreover, this form of genocide, he says, is ongoing as children are still removed from their ancestral lineages. One of the worst and most powerful things on this earth is the look in a mother's eyes and the pain she experiences when she has that which she loves most in this world taken away from her. Because the violence is ongoing, so is the trauma, mental scars that are generational in nature, in that they are passed down from parents to children in a never-ending cycle of pain. Nevertheless, what happened to the children at Kamloops Residential School, writes Adel Skander, assistant professor of global communication at Simon Fraser University, is neither unique nor surprising. Like settler colonial projects everywhere, including the Americas and Palestine, its objectives, he continues, were always a combination of land appropriation, resource extraction, and demographic engineering. The abduction of indigenous children, he concludes, was a project meant to render the worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. Given this framework, it makes sense that the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestinian children would be much the same. Indeed, in the past few days, the Zionist regime has launched a massive arrest campaign against Palestinians who participated in recent uprisings against the colonial project. As Abir Kopti notes, Zionist regime police officers, border police, and secret service members are expected to arrest approximately 500 participants in peaceful protest. Among those arrested have been children, including Abdul Khaler and Mohammad Bournat, sons of Berlin activists by Ayad Bournat. In an interview with Robert Inlakish, Bournat chronicles the history of Israeli regime aggression that has for years been unleashed on his family. Earlier in May, Zionist forces murdered his nephew Islam, a 16-year-old boy who was participating in the protest. Since then, they have repeatedly invaded his house, along with other homes, wreaking havoc and arresting the children of other families. After they took Abdul Khaler and Muhammad, my wife and my daughter don't sleep. The tears haven't left my wife's eye, said Iyad. My youngest son, Muhyiddin, he continues, Abdul Khaler and Muhammad are now in Al-Mukbiya prison, a detention facility in West Al-Quds that, Inlakish says, has a reputation for using high-level forms of torture during interrogations. Indeed, Bernard reports that his lawyer, who communicated with Abdul Khaler via computer screen, attests that the boy says he is being placed in what is known as a ghost chair for more than 15 hours a day in order to extract information that he does not have. According to Bernard, the ghost chair is small so that the hands and feet can be tightly tied to inflict a maximum amount of pain. These two boys are among the many children now in the Zionist regime jails. Palestinian journalist Zaina Halwani, recently arrested while covering protests in Sheikh Jarrah, documented her experience listening to Palestinian children screaming for their mothers during few nights that she spent in prison. In 1948, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion warned, "We must do everything to ensure Palestinians never do return." Indeed, he hoped that the old will die and the young will forget, ensuring that they would not return to their homes. This is perhaps why the Zionist regime military targets children like Abdul Khalid and Muhammad. They want to begin breaking the resistance of the Palestinians when they are young, in hopes that they will leave their land. It was also the rationale behind forcibly taking indigenous children away from their family in order to send them to the now infamous boarding schools, thereby severing their connection with the land. Fortunately for the indigenous in the Americas and in Palestine, that strategy has failed. This resistance demonstrates the spiritual relationship between indigenous peoples and their land, a connection that native people believe the pipeline will sever. Given both these examples, it is clear that colonial efforts to ethnically clear the land has completely failed. As Melissa Tassot concludes, it shouldn't take the findings of our people's remains to validate this horrible legacy of colonial regimes. Respect our humanity by respecting the results, the truth in history, and by supporting our struggle for liberation. Stop treating us the same way our kids got mistreated in residential and boarding. Stand up for indigenous rights always. The same should be said for Palestinian children too.
It was a march that never happened on the occupied territories. Israeli settlers were supposed to hold a flags march in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, but it looked like as soon as the flags march was announced, it was cancelled. The reason? Hamas threatened to activate its missiles. All this was preceded by warnings and threats issued by the Palestinian resistance, where the head of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, stressed that if the confrontation with Israel erupts again, the shape of the Middle East will be different from what it is now. Sinwar stressed that the resistance is able to achieve deterrence and was able to make possible the accumulated force. Based on the order of how the announcement was then rescinded, after Hamas made this threat, it appears that Israel has surrendered to Hamas. This conclusion is also based on Israel's loss to the Palestinian resistance faction's victory over the Israeli regime recently in the 11-day war. Israel had to surrender, stop the war, and then go to Egypt to broker a permanent ceasefire. The U.S. administration also weighed in and called on Israel not to take steps that would ignite the situation in Jerusalem.
To say that there's a permanent ceasefire, I think, is dreaming. There has never been a permanent ceasefire, and there won't be one until the siege ends and the occupation ends and there's justice for Palestinians. So again, I think that that is really hyperbole. I do believe that the U.S. pressured Israel and said, you have done enough and time to stop. But again, we've seen this pattern over and over and over again, and so I am not particularly optimistic. I think there was also pressure because of the issue around the different parties trying to coalesce around toppling Netanyahu, and that fed into the outcome.
The situation in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds remains tense, especially in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. From forced evictions to the detainment of activists, the occupied neighborhood remains a tinderbox. Most recently, Israel detained a prominent female Palestinian activist in a raid on her home in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Mona Accord leads the Safe Jarrah campaign. It's a campaign which has been trying to mobilize actions against Israel's plan to displace dozens of Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. She was released days later, but the evictions still continue, and hence the violent clashes between Palestinian resistance and Israeli occupying forces. Israel has been under heavy pressure from the resistance groups in Gaza and Lebanon. Days ago, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah Resistance Movement, warned Israel that any aggression on holy sites in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds would lead to regional war and destruction of the Tel Aviv regime.
Well, I do think that attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque are incredibly dangerous and would ignite a tremendous amount of rage amongst Muslims all over the world, and potentially a regional war. And I think it is very important that Israel not do this, and it would be catastrophic. Again, I cannot emphasize enough that Israel is a massive military power with nuclear weapons, with U.S. backing, and there have been many instances of past where Arab nations have threatened to, quote, destroy Israel, and they have been quite unsuccessful. So I think we have to be very realistic in terms of the level of military might that Israel has, given the history of the region.
Furthermore, a report has revealed that both Hamas and Hezbollah chiefs had discussed a plan for the liberation of all Palestine. This was discussed last year and prior to the 11-day war. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza war was part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during the 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. Yemen's Ansarullah also communicated with Hamas and requested coordinates for the site it wanted to target with missiles and drones, but Hamas told the popular movement not to intervene as long as the Israeli army had not crossed the red lines. Now, with a new cabinet being formed in Israel, this should serve as warning to the incoming administration to make sure the rights of Palestinians will not be violated and Palestinians will be allowed to pray in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Palestinians, however, are not holding their breath. They are rest assured, however, that resistance groups like Hamas and Hezbollah have their backs.
Tensions are growing between the West and Belarus after Minsk scrambled a fighter jet to divert the flight path of a Lithuania-bound Ryanair passenger plane and forced it to land late last month. Minutes after the landing, Belarusian authorities arrested 26-year-old opposition blogger Roman Protasevich and his fiancée who were on the plane. The move infuriated the European Union and the United States.
And Belarus used its control over its airspace in order to perpetrate a state hijacking. Therefore, the safety and security of flights through Belarus airspace can no longer be trusted.
During a summit in Brussels, EU leaders urged carriers based on the bloc to avoid flying over Belarus. In addition, they have agreed to ban Belarusian airlines from using the bloc's airspace and airports. The 27-nation bloc has slammed more economic sanctions on Belarus. The EU says it has indefinitely frozen a 3 billion euro investment package for the country. Minsk's move has been slammed by some EU leaders as, quote, state piracy.
Essentially, Belarus is very highly aligned to Russia, and that is the choice that they made. Well, this doesn't sit well with U.S. imperialist efforts who want to see all, essentially all countries in the world allied to them and subservient to them. Now, this is part of a larger U.S. strategy to try to encircle Russia within Europe. As we know that the current Ukrainian crisis is going on right now, where NATO-aligned forces are going to be fighting Russian-aligned and full-on Russian forces probably sometime in mid-June when the permafrost finally melts and it's more advantageous to move large vehicles across Ukraine. Belarus is allied to Russia.
Belarus says it requested the emergency landing due to a suspected bomb threat on the plane. The airliner then left Minsk for its destination in Lithuania shortly after. In a video broadcast by Belarusian state media, Roman Protasevich said he was in good health and cooperating with the country's officials.
Hello, my name is Roman Protasevich. I was detained yesterday at the Minsk National Airport. I'm now in the Minsk Detention Center number 1. I can state that I don't have any health issues, including heart or any other organs disease. Police officers treat me properly and according to the law. Also, I now continue to cooperate with the investigation and give a confession on organizing mass protests in Minsk.
The opposition was quick to reject the statement, arguing that Protasevich was confessing under duress. But Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the West of seeking to provoke unrest in his country. In a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko said the West is trying to, quote, rock the boat to cause a new round of protests against his government. He was referring to the outbreak of protests after the 2020 presidential election, when his opponent and Western countries accused his government of voter fraud. President Putin has also warned the West against meddling in Belarus's internal affairs. He also dismissed speculations that Russia participated in diverting the airliner.
This isn't simply someone being targeted by a country for, you know, whatever reason. There is a very clear process here. Person is wanted for a crime, and if they pass through the country, then they are going to be stopped. I mean, this is not even comparable to, say, the Chinese Huawei CFO who was stopped in Canada for a crime that doesn't even exist there.
The recent incident wasn't the first that led to rising tensions between the West and Belarus, which is in a union state with Russia, and will certainly not be the last.
Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. The UN says 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from famine. Yemen has struggled with mass outbreaks of infectious diseases, and poverty has surged to affect as much as 78% of the population since 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional states launched a devastating war on Yemen. The U.S. and several other Western countries have participated in the war by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi coalition. The United Nations says the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from an indirect cause such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. While the results of the US-sponsored Saudi aggression on Yemen speak for themselves, Washington is trying to push a narrative that the Ansarullah movement is mostly to blame for the ongoing problems in Yemen, not Saudi Arabia. After returning from a trip to some Arab states of the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, the US Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, accused Ansarullah of refusing a proposed ceasefire. However, the movement has consistently participated in peace talks with the Saudis and allies of former Saudi-backed government. The main reason for the failure of previous peace talks was that the Saudis refused any deal involving power sharing or a fresh election. That's why the Saudi-enforced war on Yemen was aimed at bringing the Saudi-backed former regime to power and crush the popular Ansarullah movement. Despite years of ongoing aggression against Yemenis and spending billions of dollars, Saudi Arabia and its supporter, the U.S., have been unable to defeat the popular Ansarullah movement, and the recent willingness to negotiate a truce proves their weakened position.
The U.S. Narrative should be ignored because it has nothing to do with reality or truth. The people of Yemen continue to suffer because of U.S. actions, because of U.S. sending weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Ansarullah movement has nothing to do with, they're defending the people of Yemen, certainly, but they are not the reason for the war. It is Saudi aggression financed by the United States that is the reason for the war.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen has accused Yemen's Ansarullah movement of not trying to reach an urgently needed ceasefire in the war-torn country. That's while the Biden administration has refused to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen, which is a key Ansarullah condition for a ceasefire. The Saudi-enforced blockade has caused a lack of food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Ansarullah movement, as well as activists and international aid groups, have been calling on Riyadh to separate the blockade from the negotiations and not use the suffering of ordinary Yemenis as a bargaining chip. Moreover, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has tried to show itself as a so-called impartial mediator, trying to resolve the ongoing conflict in Yemen. For instance, in February, the Biden administration announced that the United States was ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen. But Biden said Washington will continue to help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and land. Washington's so-called defensive support for Riyadh includes providing maintenance services to Saudi Arabia's warplanes that are bombing Yemen.
When Joe Biden became president, he made some statements about no longer financing the war in Yemen, no longer supporting it, but he continues to send arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, he calls these defensive, but that's not what they're used for. As long as the profits continue to flow to the United States, the government doesn't care who's dying, the U.S. government doesn't care whose blood is flowing, whose children are suffering and dying, as long as the profits continue to accrue to the United States. So that's what's happening now. Biden can say that he doesn't support the war anymore, but continues to send armaments that are being used in that war. So it's complete hypocrisy, which is typical for the United States. It's an ongoing, unfortunate tradition with the United States, and it's not going to stop under Joe Biden.
Washington previously announced it is halting its support for offensive Saudi-led operations in Yemen, but the U.S. is still helping Saudis in the Yemen war. Furthermore, Washington has refrained from holding Saudi Arabia accountable for the current crisis in Yemen as it has refused to pressure Riyadh into lifting the blockade on Yemen or to end its aggression. And that is a clear sign of the U.S. shielding of Saudi Arabia and Washington's contribution to this war.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, "Taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states." He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, "economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees." He accused the United States of attempting to mass-starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the U.S. blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned. No stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate that conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impacts of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace, blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode from series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to talk about, or let's say answer, some doubts or misconceptions on the important issue of Mahdaviya or Mahdism. The question of the day that we need to actually ask it from the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools, is that at the time of reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, it is as if he has brought a new book, a new divine book to the Ummah. This is the subject of a doubt or misconception posed by a questioner from extremist groups, actually a so-called scholar from some of the extremist groups in the Islam world, that wanted to actually misuse this point when also whatever has been mentioned in a hadith, that to say that Mahdi is not from Islam world. Sheikhuna, what does it mean? What does it want to signify? Does it mean that he comes with a new religion, with a new